Welcome, everybody. My name is Alan Bernstein. I'm the Executive Director of the Global HIV Vaccine Enterprise. This session is entitled New Minds, New Ideas, Attracting the Next Generation of Investigators to HIV Vaccine Research. So I know you have a lot of sessions to choose from, so I want you to thank you for choosing the Enterprise session. This session has been co-sponsored by a whole lot of organizations, which I won't name. But they're in the word that are here, and I think it reflects, the broad interest worldwide in this whole issue of how we attract the very best people to HIV vaccine research. We've lined up, a stellar cast of speakers for this afternoon, and so the structure of today's session will go like this. I will speak for as close to sort of 10 minutes as I can, and then I will be a policeman and ask our other speakers to keep within about 5 minutes. We'll have a panel discussion after each individual speaks amongst themselves, on which I will moderate, and I'll try to be provocative. And then I'll throw it open to the floor for Q's and A's and discussion points that anybody wants to make. And I think what I'd like to come out of this is not simply kind of a motherhood or fatherhood agreement that, yes, young people or people from the developing world or other fields is important, but rather the beginning perhaps of a journey of what do we do about it? How can we advise funders, institutions, investigators in the field about what to do? I'm very pleased that there's a number of young people here because I think this is all about you, obviously. Okay, so let's start right in with the slides. I'm always afraid to push the first button. Okay, so I think with the results of the STEP trial back in the last September and the recent cancellation of the PAVE trial, at least as originally proposed, I think it's fair to say that this field is at a crossroads. It has really, sparked a lot of navel-gazing in the field about where do we go from here. And a reporter just asked me whether this has been a bad year, unquote, for HIV vaccine field. And my answer was, I don't think it's been a bad year at all, in the sense that, sure, it would have been better if STEP had provided 100% efficacy and protection. But it has sparked, a lot of debate and discussion in the field about where do we go from here. And I think one of the areas where we need to go is to bring in some new people into the field. Not because the people who are currently in the field need to be all set out to pasture. On the contrary, I've been very impressed since I joined the Enterprise with the brilliance, the commitment, the passion of the scientists who are currently working in the area. But I also am very aware of how rapidly biomedical research has changed over the last 5 to 10 years. And those changes need to become incorporated as quickly as possible into discovering a safe and effective vaccine. So this slide is really meant to make that point that new people in science have always been the engine of discovery, not just in HIV field, but in every field. In fact, I think the whole history of biomedical research since the Second World War is all about new people coming into the field. So we need to encourage new young people into the field, young people or investigators from the developing world, and researchers from neighboring fields to come into the HIV vaccine research field. It's interesting to look at some data. If you just look at the far right, the Nobel Prizes in Physiology and Medicine. This is sort of a pie diagram by age of when their discovery was made. This is data that was published. I can't read the font here, I'm too old. But it's published data. Almost 90% of people who won the Nobel Prize in Physiology and Medicine, not just in the natural sciences like physics or mathematics, but even in the life sciences, were between 35 and 45, or 35 and under, and 45 when they made their discovery. That data was an eye-opener for me, because I always knew that about mathematics, that if you haven't made a great solve the great equation when you're 21, it's over, you might as well retire. But that's also true, according to this data, in physiology and medicine. Elias Zerhouni, this quote that was also, I think, in Science. In today's world, Marshall Nirenberg, some of you will know, did the really brilliant work back in the 60s that really cracked the genetic code, would get his Nobel Prize before he got his first RL1 grant. Marshall was working at the NIH when he did that work. This is, I think, a very informative histogram, a demographics of the age of principal investigators in the United States who've received NIH grants. And in the red, in the solid line there, is the demographic for 1980. You can see it peaks just under the age of 40, with investigators down at 30, going right up to 65 or so. But certainly the bulk of the investigators, the median age, is eyeballing this, is around 40. If you look today, 2007, in the yellow bars, you can see there's a demonstrable shift. And the projection, and it's just a projection for 2020, is an even greater shift. And there are lots of reasons for this, which I think are obvious. It's partly the baby boom after the Second World War. It's partly the explosion in funding for the NIH that has plateaued over the last few years. Nevertheless, that's whatever the reasons, this is the current situation. And so if you couple what I said earlier about young people are really the drivers of new ideas and new technologies with that reality. Now, those are data for the United States. I haven't shown data for other countries, but the United States is the largest biomedical research funder and population of scientists in the world, so if nothing else, the data is the best. But I suspect that that similar spectrum would be true in most other countries, certainly in the developed world, and perhaps somewhat less true in the developing world. So I think there's a challenge. I think there's particularly also a challenge because there has been a spectacular revolution, both technical and conceptual, in the life sciences over the last 5 to 10 years. I think all of us expected after the human genome was sequenced that it would just be a resource and we would tap into it and it would be very useful. I don't think anybody anticipated that the revolution would continue into the development of new ways of thinking and approaching things and new technologies. Here I'm thinking, as I've shown here, about systems biology, computational biology, RNA libraries, microarrays, and gene chips. None of that, I think it's fair to say, was anticipated when the discussions about sequencing the human genome first started. It really is a classic example of how engaging on a new project has led to spin-offs that could not have been and were not, in fact, anticipated when the Human Genome Project started. And I suspect, I'm not going to predict the future, I suspect that this revolution has not stopped, and in fact, it's still accelerating. And all the more reason that we need to make, I think, deliberate efforts to make sure that we incorporate these new technologies and new ideas into the HIV vaccine field. So to me, the rationale for talking about this is not just that young is good, but rather there's been a revolution going on in thinking and that young people are driving this revolution and we need to make sure that they're at the HIV vaccine table. So what do we do to attract new researchers? And this is an extremely incomplete list, and it's by no means meant to be exhaustive in any sense. It is meant to, I think, convey some of the approaches one can think about, and some things, again, just in bullet form, that that organizations are currently doing, being aware of the problem. Peer review, I think worldwide, is notoriously conservative in how it approaches grants and new science. And as you all know, everyone complains about peer review, but no one has a better system to replace it. It's a little bit like democracy. That doesn't mean, though, that it's perfect, and it doesn't mean that we shouldn't be questioning it all the time and thinking about novel approaches to doing peer review. I think particularly because the nature of biomedical science is changing. The way research is done today, I think, bears no resemblance to the way how biomedical research is being done when I first started 1,000 years ago in research. For one thing, the size of a group has changed profoundly from a principal investigator, one technician, a graduate student, and a postdoc when you start, to if you really want to be competitive, you need a team of 10 to 20 people. And so how do we review an individual who's one of that team of 10 to 20 people? Or do we? Do we care about that? So there's a whole slew of issues that need to be vigorously debated in a cultural context of each country. Various organizations, the NIH, the Gates Foundation, Howard Hughes, the World Academy of Sciences, the Wellcome Trust in the UK, to name just a few, have implemented programs that I think are experiments that we all should be watching carefully to see about what is the best way of bringing new young people into the field. Perceptions. I think one of the issues for young people, and this is me speaking, I'd be very interested in hearing what young people have to say, are the perception of this field. The perception is that it's about product development. And if you just got your PhD or an MD or whatever, what do you know about product development? Nothing. And so you figure this field is not for you. But I think that this field is really at the cutting edge of human immunology, which has got to be one of the most interesting areas of biomedical research today. And so we need to, I think, hire a PR firm to project. This is about, as Tony Fauci said recently, we need to emphasize more basic science. And amongst others, about immunology and other areas of basic science, it's not just about making a product. We need to also, I think, acknowledge but also discuss and debate this issue of how modern biomedical research has profoundly changed. I mean, large, interdisciplinary, how do we, in that context, recognize and provide opportunities for young people? So I've glossed over a lot of things, which I hope some of our panelists will touch on in more depth and hopefully will be touched on in the discussion that follows. We have a star-studded group. And what we were trying to put together are a combination of diverse people who represent the funders, some of the funders, obviously we can't represent all of them, young people from a developed country and from a developing country, and a European perspective from a scientist. So we're going to start off with Jose Esparza. I won't give the bios of each of them because I'll use up all the time we have available. They all have long bios. Jose Esparza from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Dan Baruch from Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center at Harvard, Peggy Johnson from NIAID and NIH, Giuseppe Pantaleo from Centre Hospitalier Université Vaudois in Switzerland, and Tumpi Dungu from the University of KwaZulu-Natal in South Africa. So, Jose, I'll ask you to come.
Okay. So, many thanks, Alan, for this opportunity to briefly share with you some of my views on this important topic in 5 minutes or less. One of the issues that we will be discussing today is related to the fact that the average age of what we call, some people call, research independence is increasing. Today, as Alan mentioned, the average age, or implied at least, the average age for the first grant is, for the NIH grant, is 42 years. The first academic appointment happens when the scientist is 39. The percentage of new investigators competing from grants, new investigators, has declined to 25%. And as Alan mentioned, indicated, the average age of principal investigators in the U.S. is 50 years old. And this analysis is for all areas of research and probably not unique to HIV vaccines. Now, much has been said and written about the age of peak scientific achievement which is between 30 and 40 years. And incidentally, this is the same peak age for jazz musicians, painters, writers, and even for criminals. And this is recorded in the literature. Now, one interpretation given is that this peak is related to the competitive drive in early adulthood. We also know, that, as Alan showed, that most Nobel laureates obtain their awards for work done in their 30s. In fact, for work done during the first decade of their scientific careers. But we should keep in mind, however, that if the average age of discovery is between 30 and 40 years of age, in fact, half of the discoveries are made by people who are older than that. So there is hope for some of us. This is a poem from Paul Dirac, who got the Nobel Prize in Physics when he was 31 years old. And that happened only 6 years after he finished his PhD. But I ask myself if it's that true that there is not intelligent life after the 30s. In fact, Harry Zuckerman maintained in a great book that is indicated there, she maintained that there were a few myths that needed to be considered, including that the contributions to science come disproportionately from young scientists. A lot come from older scientists. Or that good scientists burn after they have done their best work in their youth. Or that if you had not done some significant work in your early life, you will never do it, and perhaps it is better for you to take early retirement. With all these caveats, a summary statement of the problem is that the average age for research independence is now occurring after the average age of scientific creativity. But we will need to generate data to confirm that this is true in the field of HIV vaccines, and to learn, more importantly, to learn how this situation could be affecting progress. But there are other more mundane problems affecting young scientists, such as the lack of professional security and career paths, or the hierarchical structure of research that does not provide enough visibility to the young scientist, and the need to work in large teams will reduce independence for the young scientist. And in fact, those factors are delaying the time when a young scientist gets his or her first own grant, that is when he or she really becomes an established scientist. Possible solutions include a two-track peer review system with allocated funds for young researchers, or small innovation grants like the Gates Foundation Grand Challenge Exploration, or career development awards. And the Europeans have also proposed a very intriguing charter for young investigators that you can check in the internet. But we also need to give young scientists a chance to express their own scientific views. And I have a suggestion to make in my next and last slide. This suggestion, this suggestion is based on an experience related to young physicists described by Michael Thompson in the reference given in the slide. The idea is to invite young scientists to submit review articles that are provocative, where young scientists describe some recent cutting edge research and then put that in the wider context, looking forward to the future. And perhaps this is an activity that the enterprise could promote. And of course, the first thing to do is to find a sympathetic journal editor willing to take that risk. And many thanks for your attention, and I look forward to the discussion.
Thank you. Thanks. I'd like to thank Alan and the Enterprise for highlighting this as a topic, as well as providing the forum to discuss these issues today. I'd like to share with you today some of my own perceptions and opinions regarding challenges that are facing young investigators, specific for the HIV vaccine field, and I'd like to say that probably all of these views are really just some observations and personal opinions that I've had and I've developed over a couple of years. So as everyone knows, there have been some disappointing news over the past year with the failure of the STEP studies in the HIV vaccine field. And to help focus and, to some extent, redirect the field, there was a summit on HIV vaccine research and development that was held in March of this year at the NIH. And there's lots of debatable points that were raised during this meeting. However, there appeared to be broad agreement on the following three themes. First, that major scientific challenges face the HIV vaccine field. Second, that increased innovation and discovery research is required to address these challenges. And third, that it's critical to recruit and to retain new investigators to the field. I think there is a commitment now by the funding organizations to foster innovation and to attract new investigators to this field, perhaps more so now than ever. And I'd like to encourage the young investigators in the room to embrace the challenges of the field as opportunities to tackle some of the most interesting and complex scientific problems of our time, and opportunities to contribute to some of the most important global health problems of our time. However, I do think there are some unique challenges that are facing young investigators in the HIV vaccine field that, of course, overlap somewhat with the general challenges facing young investigators in biomedical research. But I think that there are specific challenges for the HIV vaccine field in terms of scientific challenges, career development challenges, and structural challenges. As I think people in this room probably know, the scientific challenges facing HIV vaccine development remain unprecedented in the history of vaccinology. Unlike successful vaccines for many other pathogens, for HIV, there's extensive viral clade and sequence diversity. Immune correlates of protection are not clear. The virus can rapidly evolve to evade both humoral and cellular immune responses. Antibody responses elicited by natural infection or vaccination are typically narrow and type-specific. There's no method that currently exists to generate broadly reactive neutralizing antibodies. Attenuated viruses that afford dramatic protection in monkeys are too unsafe for use in humans in the present form. There's a lack of small animal model of disease, thus necessitating the use of expensive and cumbersome non-human primates for preclinical vaccine testing. There's also little pharmaceutical interest and industry interest in the HIV vaccine field, unlike other fields such as the therapeutics field, where there's a clear profit motive that engages industry more effectively. And also, as everybody knows, there's been the failure of prototype antibody and T-cell based vaccine candidates to date, namely the Vaxgen GP120 vaccines in 2003 and the Merck Ad5 GAG-PalNF vaccines last fall. In addition to the scientific challenges, there are career development challenges facing young investigators in the HIV vaccine field. Vaccine research, to some extent, is very complex in that it involves many different intersecting fields. Thus, for someone to be successful in vaccine work, a broad base and flexible training is required. Training has to be in multidisciplinary research using complex experimental systems. In addition, there's a critical need to have a longitudinal and dedicated mentorship, not only at the postdoctoral and clinical fellow level, but also when people actually get their first R01 grant and become junior faculty, then the mentorship is perhaps as important, if not more important, at that phase in their careers. And of course, this comes at a time when there's limitations on funding. The NIH budget has been flat now for about 5 years, with reduced pay lines, not only for R01 grants, but also reductions in pay lines for career development grants, such as K-Awards, which are the lifeblood of a lot of fellow to faculty transitions. And as has just been mentioned by Jose, increasing the age of receipt of the first initial major NIH grant and probably can be generalized to grants in general. And of course, institutional support is required. In addition to constraints on research funding, there's also constraints on clinical funding. And so there are competing demands and increasingly complex competing demands that are placed on junior faculty in academic medical centers, particularly those who do not have their first major NIH grant. And so for them, it becomes a vicious circle in which it's hard to establish research independence if you're not actually putting the hours into the lab. And of course, this signifies the need for institutional commitment in protecting research time. In addition, there are structural challenges associated with the HIV vaccine field that I think are important for young investigators. The complexity of the field over the last several years has necessitated the establishment of large research-based consortiums, and I think there is some level of natural tensions between consortium-based big science versus investigator-initiated research projects. From the perspective of young investigators, and of course these tensions are often productive and not necessarily negative, but how they are managed I think are important for encouraging young investigators. From the perspective of young investigators, particularly those who have some role as a part of consortiums and or have some role trying to establish their own independent research programs, there's some natural tensions between engaging in collaborative research projects and independence, both in terms of conducting the research, creatively exploring new avenues, as well as, perhaps most importantly, making sure to receive credit for the research that's done. And of course, there's different philosophies of how these are run in terms of timeline milestone-driven approaches versus innovation creativity-based approaches, goal-oriented approaches, versus exploratory research approaches. And perhaps the field actually needs all of the above. And so it's not a so I think there is a tension between these forces that is not necessarily negative, but I think has to be managed appropriately to make sure that the systems are in place to continue to encourage junior investigators. Another structural challenge in the field is that substantial resources are often required for proving the point in developing a novel vaccine concept. In the HIV vaccine field, then developing a novel vaccine concept often requires non-human primate challenge studies and or human clinical trials, both of which are extraordinary and complex and expensive. And everyone agrees that new ideas are needed and need to be encouraged. New investigators are often the source of innovation, and yet resources are rarely concentrated in the hands of new investigators. And so one could put forth an argument that the field perhaps is not capitalizing on innovative potential of young investigators. So I'd like to conclude just with this slide in that I think there are some unique challenges that do face young investigators in the HIV vaccine field. An observation that I've made, I don't think it's substantiated by any data, but I'd be interested to see if other people feel the same way, is that there's a curious age distribution of investigators in our field, in that many of the senior investigators appear to be of a relatively similar age, likely related to their synchronous entry into the field in the mid-1980s. And I think there's a growing realism that the senior investigators in the field realize that they are likely not going to be the ones to solve this problem, and therefore the responsibility to continue the HIV vaccine field will fall to the next generation of investigators, and likely even the one after that. So I think because of that, the role of junior investigators in the HIV vaccine field is critical and needs to be viewed as such by the funding organizations, conference organizers, senior investigators, and institutions. Funding organizations to provide the support for junior investigators, conference organizers, journal editors, etc., to make sure that young investigators are recognized for their accomplishments. Senior investigators to provide mentorship, and institutions to provide a career development structure that's appealing and long-lasting for young investigators. I think I'll stop there.
So, I think I'm going to just focus on the first question of this slide, and that is what is needed to attract and retain young researchers. And there's a number of topics that my co-panelists have focused on, but one of the keys that I believe is important for success is mentorship. So I'm going to focus on mentorship, what mentors should do, and what people who are looking for mentors should look for in their mentor. I think, first of all, it helps to have an institution that values research and research training. And I think this is a particularly challenging task for those in resource-poor settings, where the demand for resources are so keen elsewhere. To think about investment in research seems like a luxury. But in fact, I'm hoping that as time goes on, there'll be a realization that investment in research will pay off in having better biomedical care in the vicinity of that research infrastructure. I think it's also important to tailor the research and the project that the individual works on to their strengths and their desires. And it's important for the mentor to get to know the person and what they want to do, what they see as their strengths, how they wish to pursue their career, because the path that the mentor followed may not be the right path for the mentee to follow. And so it's important not to, as this picture depicts, not to try to put a square peg in a round hole, so to speak. Next is finding the appropriate research project that the individual can take with them when they leave without having to go to war with the mentor. I think this is particularly important in AIDS vaccine research now, and where there are some very key opportunities to bring in new technologies into the field. The systems biology, the proteomics, the genomics, these are things that people of my generation have not done. So the younger generation can take these new tools that have been used in other fields and bring them in and apply them to the field of AIDS vaccines and have something that is their own to take with them. I think it's important for the mentor and the mentee to agree on the eventual path to independence. What will transpire, how will things go, so the person can eventually gain their independence and have their own research project and not feel like they're, you know, the slave of the senior faculty member for decades and decades. I think it's also important for the mentor to keep the person on track and stay focused on the research project. It's often easy to want to do a number of different things, and that's not that may be good for later in one's career, but I think early in the career it's important to show success. And it's very difficult to show success if you're trying to do too many things and not being focused. And finally, I think it's important for the mentor to show a vision of the importance of this research. Sometimes it gets to be so grueling in the lab and you get into the day-to-day grind so much that it's hard to keep a vision of how this is actually going to help AIDS vaccine development. And I think that's something that the mentor can and should provide. And finally, and I can't stress this enough, because I can't tell you how many PhDs and MDs that I've tried to mentor that couldn't write a sentence. Teaching them to learn to write really well, especially grants, and to speak well and to present well is absolutely essential to their success. Especially important for individuals where English is not their first language. This takes time and it takes effort, and the mentors need to spend a lot of time doing this, helping write, reading, helping edit, not doing it for them, but teaching them. And I have to say, of all the things that I got from my graduate education, this was one that I particularly valued. I learned more about English and writing from my PhD advisor than I did in my previous however many decades of schooling I had. And I was very thankful to him for that, doing that. Being available is also helpful once the person leaves your laboratory. And also realizing that there is something in this for you to put this extra effort into mentoring. It's not that someone's going to pin a medal on your chest and say, hey, you've been a great mentor. But if you, as a mentor, are seen as a place where people can come and be successful and leave and be successful, I guarantee you there will be a line of people out your door waiting to come and train with you. I think I'm going to skip this last part and maybe leave that for the discussion. And thank you for your attention.
Good afternoon. First of all, I would like to thank Adam for the invitation. And I think we should recognize that it's really since he moved in the office drawing attention to very critical issues for the HIV vaccine field, then I'm not entitled to represent Europe, just to tell you that. Also because living and working in Switzerland is not even part of the European Union. Then I'm going to give you some personal, you know, ideas. And actually, then the issues that we are discussing today are, you know, exploring strategies for attracting new investigators, embracing the latest technologies and then engaging investigators from areas most affected by HIV/AIDS. I'm going to limit the discussion about only on the first point. Now, I could have offered to you my personal perspective, but actually what I did also because, you know, there was some discussion how to organize this session. What I did, I went to young investigators and then I asked why they don't want to join the HIV vaccine field. And if you will see these sentences that are not very so well organized as the previous speakers, but this is exactly what they will answer to you if you are questioning them. Now, in my mind, the problem is not the lack of young investigators, but is what is missing is young leadership in the field, and related to this also the difficulty in attracting brilliant young investigators. Let me give you the definition of a brilliant young investigator. He's somebody who has completed a very successful postdoc that has published several important papers in not necessarily the HIV vaccine field, because what we need to attract are people from other fields, not people that they grow up in the HIV vaccine field. And then, actually, I have my personal experience because 3 years ago, I recruited somebody who is, I think he's a very brilliant guy, one of the most brilliant that I have ever worked with. He was trained in Roth-Zeigler-Nagel lab, first in Zurich, and then he spent 3 years working with Jonathan Sprent at Scripps. But the first thing that he said, he wrote me, he said, I want to join, I want to come to Lausanne, I want to join the service of immunology, but I'm not going to work on HIV. Then, that is just to give you an idea, he wants, these young, brilliant scientists that are very well trained in immunology, they want to show, their challenge is to show that they can, move their own ideas. They are not going, to move in a field. Well, fundamentally, everything, it's going to be put in a big, melt pot. Anyway, where the problem is? Now, these are the questions. Well, first of all, they will tell you that they have very limited independence in developing their own ideas, creativity. They don't have an independent laboratory. Okay, right away. In fact, when he joined, I gave him an independent laboratory. There is the feeling too, that the one becomes just a component of a big machine. And I think that this is really true because, with also the number of, the resources that you need, I think that today in the field, if somebody makes a small experiment, nobody cares about the data. That is what is dramatic. I mean, if you don't have people presenting from big centers that are going to present you 250 mice experiment or 45 monkeys, nobody really pays attention to what you're saying. But that is the problem, huh? And I think that this is a problem of the entire field. Now, what are the other answers? Well, they think that there is too much technical work involved. Then the scale of the amount of work that you need to do, particularly technical, they think that is not really very interesting with regard really to be able to prove certain ideas that in their mind they need very specific experiments rather than going on a very large scale. I mean, for example, they don't need to have standardized methods in order to prove their ideas. If at least new ideas, then it's too risky. And I think that is very true. There is an investment of several years for an unpredictable outcome. That is really a major problem. How can you ask to somebody who is a brilliant investigator, the guy that I am talking, he published Science, Nature, Immunology, Nature, several experiments when he was with Jonathan Sprent, and he wants to prove his own idea. Then he's going to take a risk for 5-6 years not publishing anything. Something that is a problem of the field. Then they are really scared that the good ideas will be further developed, taken over by other investigators with different expertise within the big machine. And then I think to a certain extent this happens. Because at a certain moment, if the young guy does not have the resources, somebody is taking over. And then what also is the big problem is the lack of a clear career plan. Maybe this is more for Europe than for United States, but fundamentally in Europe, the way how academics are organized, these young people, they request a career plan when they join the institution. Now, can the founders solve the problem? Well, I'm bringing up here an example that has been working very, very well in Switzerland. Okay, Switzerland is a very small country. You can't really, translate to what it may happen in big countries. But in Switzerland, what it has been developed is a young investigator's tenure track program. And then, fundamentally, what this program involves is that if the institution gets award, the funding for the creation of an independent research laboratory, then at this point the institution needs to guarantee to warrant the development of an independent scientific program, creation of an independent research group, financial independence, commitment of the hosting institution to provide laboratory infrastructures, and then also to develop a career plan. Then, in other words, if this person is successful at the end of 5 years, generally this is a 5 years program, then the institution should guarantee, a position and the possibility that the person can continue, its own career.
I will stop here.
And thank you for your attention.
Well, I think Alan and the Enterprise, first of all, for the boldness to actually have me speak in this session. I think the problem I'm going to describe is obviously most obvious with resource-poor settings, particularly African countries, which are the ones that are worst affected by the HIV-AIDS epidemic. And therefore, I think that there is, in fact, a moral obligation not only on the part of Africans, but also, I think, on the part of the global research community, and particularly the global vaccine research community, to actually involve African investigators and other investigators from other resource-poor countries in HIV vaccine research. So I think if you all agree that there's a moral obligation to involve researchers from resource-poor settings, the question is, what are the challenges that are unique to investigators, particularly in African settings and other resource-poor settings, and how do you address some of these challenges? I think the problems I think within African for African researchers are fairly obvious, and they include obviously limited research infrastructure. I don't think that I need to expound more on that. Limited political will, particularly by African governments and also institutions of higher learning where these young investigators should be working or are already working, and also lack of capacity for mentorship and grantsmanship, which also has been raised not just for resource-poor settings, but also even in the rich countries, but it's particularly more acute, I think, within the resource-poor settings. The challenges also include limited opportunities for career growth, which leads to brain drain, and it creates a vicious cycle where you go to meetings like this and we are always complaining about lack of leadership among Africans and the fact that the best brains from Africa and other resource-poor settings are moving to Europe and to America and other places. And yet, it's a cycle that sort of feeds itself. And I think part of the reason for that is limited opportunities for career advancement within the institutions and within the countries from which these researchers come from. I think African researchers, more than other places, are faced with economic hardships and issues that are at a very basic level, such as poor salaries that attracts some of the best brains from these countries to other places where there is better personal remuneration and career advancement. There are also cumbersome bureaucracies in African countries. And then, of course, there's the paucity of rigorous academic and research environments that can nurture investigators so that they can become independent investigators or so that they can participate actively in HIV vaccine research. Some of the opportunities, I just wanted to highlight some of the opportunities that are there, because it is easy to talk about the challenges that African researchers face, but I think there are also opportunities within African countries and within African institutions that really need to be exploited by people that are interested in advancing careers of African researchers. I would argue that in some cases it is actually easier and faster to do HIV vaccine research in Africa. Of course, there's availability of study cohorts that are accessible much more in African countries. And I would argue that even for biomedical research at the basic level, that sometimes it is in fact easier because you are actually working with people who are cooperative, who actually understand the problem and who are very enthusiastic about solving the problem because they have seen the effects of the problem firsthand, much more than young investigators, for example, in developed countries. I think also the opportunity for direct impact on communities and institutions is a big incentive, I think, to get involved in impacting communities and institutions in Africa. I think there's need to invest in local leadership. There's need for local ownership and attributable credits by collaborators. I think that if you look at some of the institutions, the few institutions in African countries and other resource poor settings that have really done well, most of them have been because there have been strong collaborations with researchers from Western countries. And I would like to emphasize the need for investigators that are collaborating from Western countries to actually give attributable credit to the investigators that are working in these resource poor settings. I think there's also a need for long-term partnerships, and this is particularly directed at funders, to really put in money to support, as well as actually collaborating investigators, to put in money and also to facilitate rather than compete, to put forward sustainable funding, centers of excellence that can be developed, because obviously we are not going to develop cutting-edge vaccine research in every city in Africa, but certainly we can come up with funding structures that will support centers of excellence in some places, in selected places, that could then act as a, as places from where other African researchers can be developed, and even researchers from Western countries can come and do productive work. I just wanted to finish with a little bit of my own personal sort of profile here, because I think I do represent to an extent a researcher who is actually involved actively in HIV vaccine research within the African continent. And I just wanted to highlight my training a little bit and say that I have a degree from the University of Nairobi and got my PhD at Harvard. And the reason I was able to go back and work in Africa, and for which I'm very proud, is because of seed funding from my alma mater, my primary institution, which is Harvard, where I trained for my PhD. The fact that they were able to invest in me and have faith in me and send me back there with seed funding to go and establish a research lab within Africa. And also great collaborations that have worked very well over the years with investigators from the developed countries and people who have really allowed me to do what I'm interested in doing and actually set a research agenda rather than them coming and dictating the kind of research that I should be doing and that I should be involved in. And I just wanted to finish there with a photograph of my research institution, which is the Doris Duke Medical Research Institute. And I think we need more Doris Duke Medical Research Institutes in Africa that can nurture African researchers, because I think that this problem ultimately will be solved as a result of collaboration between researchers in resource-poor settings that are most affected by the problem, as well as investigators in developed countries. Thank you very much.